Okay, thanks very much, everybody. And thanks very much to David for that interesting overview. My name's Margaret Gray. I'm very grateful to John Breslin as chair and to the committee of the Financial Services Bar Association for inviting me to moderate this session. I think, as Ms. Justice Butler made it very clear, there are lots of very complex issues which are already the subject of some interesting discussions, and now we have the bill to deal with as well. So this panel is going to take as its topic walking the investigation tightrope. So we're going to offer some acrobatics this afternoon. We hope that we'll be able to manage to walk the tightrope without ending up too much on the floor. But certainly there are going to be some very knotty issues, I think, to discuss. And we have an expert panel of speakers. For you have Rob Kane, who's here from Arthur Cox. We have next to Rob, John Freeman from the Bar of Ireland, who's also a founding member of the association, Karen Reynolds from Matheson, and we have John O'Riordan, who is here from Dillon Eustace, and these are all expert litigators. They're experts in financial services and regulation, and they're going to be talking us through the life cycle of an investigation. So what we'd like to do is a really kick off. Rob's going to lay out the land just to explain how an investigation might work in very high-level terms. And then the panelists are going to discuss various issues that are likely to arise. So how might an investigation be triggered? What are the issues that you have to deal with as regards information and evidence gathering powers that the bank has? We're going to look at how things will change with the new bill, particular problems that might arise in relation to issues of self-incrimination, and particularly looking to see how the regime, which I think can very reasonably be characterised as a rather soft law regime, obviously raises some very hard law and very serious issues and consequences. So I'd like to hand over to Rob, and I'd like to say the experts are absolutely beyond compare. Their bios are in the programme, so I won't be taking you through that, but I think we can just say that you're going to hear some very interesting discussion.
Thanks, Rob. Thank you. Afternoon, everybody. I think the first thing to say to a room full of litigators here this afternoon is that the investigation processes that are run by the central bank are not litigation processes. So I think you need to sort of move from your mind the usual concepts and issues and challenges that you go through commercial litigation or arbitration or mediation cases. We're talking here very much about a regulatory process and a fairly unusual regulatory process, an unusual sort of regulatory beast, as will become evident, I think, as we go through this session. There is a legislative basis to the investigations that the central bank runs. It's set under Part 3C of the Central Bank Act 1942, and there's guidance that the central bank has issued as well that sort of provides additional colour and some clarity as to how the process runs. But I think the best way to view the legislative framework is really as sort of setting the basis for the investigations, because actually what happens during an investigation from the central bank's perspective, and also from the perspective of firms who are being investigated, or indeed individuals who are being investigated, isn't really prescribed at all. And others may correct me, but certainly my experience is that each investigation is run in a different way by the central bank. There are commonalities, but very often there are differences an approach taken by the central bank's various investigation teams. So there's a legislative framework underpinning it. There's a statutory basis for what is happening during an investigation. What happens within the wrapper of that investigation can vary from time to time. One of the really unusual things, I think, in relation to the central bank investigations is that the central bank acts as policeman, prosecutor, judge, and jury, and I think in some cases as well it supplies the witnesses to the case. That creates a challenging dynamic, but also a particularly sort of unique perspective to the way that the case is run. the only point at which an independent arbiter of the facts might become involved is if the case goes to inquiry. I think one of the panels is going to talk in a bit more detail about inquiries later, and we're going to touch upon it now. But it's only if a case goes to a formal inquiry that there's a genuine sort of independent analysis of the facts, the arguments, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of where investigations come from, my day-to-day job, whilst I do some sort of contentious regulatory work, my day-to-day job is advising clients on non-contentious matters, so how to comply with the law so they hopefully don't end up the subject of an investigation from the central bank. Clients generally tend to know when an investigation is coming, not because they've been badly advised by me or by our colleagues in other firms, but because they have had to admit to the central bank that something has gone wrong, an individual has made a mistake, a process has failed, etc., etc. Or there's been an inspection by the central bank, which has sort of thrown up an issue of non-compliance with the law, et cetera, et cetera. So firms tend to know when an investigation is coming, or at least if they're well advised, they'll have a sense that an investigation is likely. So they don't tend to come as a complete surprise, albeit the timing can sometimes be a surprise. And the way that the investigations start is through receipt of a letter. You get an investigation letter that sets out a series of what we call suspected prescribed contraventions, with a request to respond by a set date, with a series of admissions or denials and an explanation as to what did or didn't happen in relation to the contraventions. And then you're left to it to respond to that letter. You then end up with a process over an extended period of time whereby there's an exchange of correspondence, responses to the letters. I should say you're under no formal legal obligation to respond to the letters. Central Bank makes that clear. What you do get in the meantime will be a series of statutory requests for information, and we'll touch upon this in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. You get requests for information in sort of documentary form. You may get requests for interviews to give evidence to the central bank. And this process goes backwards and forwards over a fairly extended period of time, generally ending at some point with a settlement, which, I go back to the point I made at the start around these processes being unusual, is not a settlement in the way that you would have come across as day-to-day commercial litigators, no doubt. It is a settlement in all but name, and again, we'll talk about that later as well. So that's a very high-level overview. The other principles we've talked about we'll go through in more detail over the next few minutes, but we thought it would be useful just to give you that sort of overarching head start.
Rob, I think it's very interesting what you say about the central bank being investigator and policeman and prosecutor, and how that plays into how they then exercise the powers in the statutory powers that they have. Before we move on to look, I think and John's going to look at how that's changed or will change under the bill. Could you just give a couple of kind of do's and don'ts for what happens whenever that letter arrives from your, particularly given what we've just been discussing about the mélange of powers and what the central bank can actually do, but when the letter arrives and you're advising your client?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a bit of a stage of a process of talking people down off the ledge. Yeah. People clearly don't like getting these sorts of letters. They're, you know, really serious when you get one. The way that we approach it is, having tried to calm the client down, generally they know it's coming, but to explain to them what the process is going to involve, and that can be sometimes very challenging, particularly where you've got clients who have gone through similar experiences in the UK or the US or elsewhere. That process is quite unusual, so there's a period of explaining what's going on. We try and get the client to understand the process, what's likely to come ahead, to get staff to understand what might happen, try and start the process of collecting some of the internal evidence. We remind them of the rules around privilege and stuff like that. And then we also talk to them about the importance of engaging with the central bank and treating it like a regulatory exercise. So, you know, being very mindful that these cases arise because the supervisory, the regulatory relationship is broken down in some way and needs to be repaired. So it's important to engage with the central bank with that in mind as well. So you have your litigation hat on, and you also have your sort of regulatory relationship hat on as well to manage things in the background. But a key point is setting the scene for the clients and explaining to them that they are going to be involved in a process which is unusual and strange, and which they will find frustrating and challenging and will be lengthy. I mean, others may have views as well and things that they do.
Yeah, John, you've got a regulatory and litigation hat there that I'm sure you're happy to take off and share the secrets inside it with us.
It is. Well, what's really good now for the to see the 2022 bill is the first time to see a statutory basis for the investigation. So, as Rob says, it's had a statutory purpose until now. So it's the process whereby the bank satisfies itself. Are there reasonable grounds to suspect a prescribed contravention and sort of what should we do about it? So now that hasn't had a statutory basis until now. The investigation letters that Rob described have said, you know, this is for the purpose of an investigation, but it's not exercising any particular power. Quite often the request for information doesn't exercise a statutory power either. And just maybe just to compare as we pass by, in the UK, when the investigation starts by the Financial Conduct Authority, it does have a statutory basis, and the regulator tends to invoke statutory powers, and their guidance is that is better in terms of transparency. I think that's a valid point. So, yes, statutory basis for the investigation is the first thing. And then the bill adds a bit of structure. So Rob's described from the outside for a respondent, it's a little bit unclear what's actually happening inside the central bank or what they're up to or when you should expect output. There is now going to be a bit of structure. You'll get a notification of investigation as soon as practicable after the bank decides to start an investigation. We don't know exactly what the trigger for that is going to be, but it has to be that the bank suspects a prescribed contravention or has reasonable grounds to suspect that. The respondent or the subject will have a chance to come back on that notice and comment on it. And then there's a second round of commentary. There's an investigation report will be drawn up in draft, and the subject will have a chance to comment on that. And then that ends up before the inquiry. And this was something that was maybe in a little bit of controversy at some of the inquiries that have ran in the past. What's the exact status of this investigation report? The central bank was very, very hot on it, or keen on it, to use an untechnical phrase, and said it should be before the inquiry. It's very helpful. And respondents had different views. The heads said that it would have full evidential status before the inquiry, and that the bill seems to do something just a little bit short of that. So it's to be before the inquiry. The inquiry must have regard to it, but as what exactly, we just don't know. On submissions, so that's the third thing, an aspect of this structure. You have a chance to make submissions on the investigation report in draft. As Rob said, this is not litigation. You don't have an exchange of pleadings. You don't have timetables under the rules of court. So the structure that I've described is as much as you have. But this exchange of notices and reports, like that's drawing the battle lines in a real way, and that's going to end up before an inquiry. So you want your response to that to be as complete as it can be and to put your best foot forward. And I don't think the bill allows that to happen, arguably, because when you look at it, there's a presumptive time period of 7 days to respond to the draft investigation report, which is strikingly short. And that can be extended, but the starting point is 7 days. We just pick some other stuff that came out in 2022 as a comparison. I don't know if everyone was keeping track of the European Union veterinary medical product and medicated feed regulations.
Great interest.
I see a lot of heads nodding. So there's a provision there where the veterinary regulator can stop a veterinary medical product or who knows, maybe medicated feed circulating and put a stop on that. And if they serve a notice, you have 7 days to respond to that. So that's kind of an urgent animal health or safety issue, gives you 7 days. To pick an example closer to home, the Competition Amendment Act has a sort of similar structure. The regulator there can serve a statement of objections, and the subject undertaking is to have an opportunity to respond to that. And that doesn't have any presumptive time period. And that reflects, when you look at the recitals to the ECN Plus Directive, your rights of defence require an opportunity to make your views known and a reasonable opportunity. So I just think There's maybe a question mark as to whether 7 days to respond to the investigation report hits that, and if this maybe might be something could benefit from a bit of reflection at the committee stage in the Oireachtas.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, just give us a flavour of the range of issues that you would need to be dealing with within your 7 days. I mean, you've got a report presented to you. It's the result of significant work. It's setting out a case, right?
This is it. And if you think compare the timetables for pleadings in any of the divisions of the courts or at any level of the courts, think that you're, on my count, there's 440 different pieces of regulation or law which could be in the mix, and they probably won't all be. The Central Bank Acts are mesmerising in their complexity. They're not consolidated. They're hard to get a grip on, as the other speakers have mentioned. So, you know, 7 days seems demanding.
There's also challenges. Lots of clients are complex. They have global operations. People who are key decision makers are located all over the world. So doing anything within 7 days is difficult enough, let alone respond to a complex investigation report, which I think is just... I mean, it bears no relation to the length of time that investigations currently go on for.
I think, Karen, I'd like to bring you in. I know you've got some interesting comments about a range of things, including actually just what John was saying about comparison with European law and what European law protections are provided for when you're looking at investigations and drawing on European Convention on Human Rights, for example, like in the DB case. But also I know that you'd like to talk about more, perhaps roll up your sleeves and a few practical questions and what happens and how an investigation actually might get triggered and what you want to do in that regard. So I'd be very happy to hear, we all would be very happy to hear from you on any of those issues.
There's certainly no shortage of topics on this particular theme anyway. So I think, you know, it's probably a good parameter framework to put it in. It's when you're dealing with the investigation letter and the types of things that come up. So certainly Robert mentioned things like privilege and thinking about that. And interestingly, and I think what you're getting at is sort of the privilege against self-incrimination in particular, and when individuals or firms are under investigation, what information are they giving to the central bank? What can they be compelled to give? And when the question arises as to whether or not that information is going to leave them open to other and potential criminal or very penal sanctions, what the obligation is in terms of disclosing that information. But I think if you rewind back just a little bit in terms of the triggers for investigations as well, the timing might well be a surprise to some degree. Often you get a bit of a heads up from the central bank because the central bank obviously supervises on a day-to-day basis as well. And generally speaking, these investigations start after a period of what I call kind of heightened supervisory engagement. Generally, the firm has reported a breach. Often that can be binary. Did you do something or did you not do something? It's a yes or no answer. You've just self-reported it. And the writing sort of on the wall from that, from the get-go. Generally speaking, you end up in a scenario where there's been a regulatory failing or a breach, but do you have systems and controls issues? Do you have governance issues? And that's when things begin to get a little bit more difficult, because whilst a firm may or may not have complied with the requirement to make a return, an individual might be more concerned about, well, why wasn't that made on time? Was it a system and control failure? Did somebody forget to press a button? Was somebody not aware of the information that had to go into the return? Is that a training issue? Is that a competency issue? So immediately you start to get into scenarios which are a little bit more complex than just a corporate regulatory failing issue. You get into scenarios where individuals' livelihoods are on the line, and in the context of an investigation, that becomes quite complex. And I think when you look at the individual accountability framework and SEER in particular, those questions are going to come all the more to the fore. And particularly, I think Rob will touch on it in a little bit more detail, when you're into the scenario of statutory information requests and interviews, all of these things become live issues. So the firm will have representation. Do the individuals need representation also? How does that work in terms of access to books and records? How does it work in terms of conflicts of interest? There's some really, really tricky issues that you need to navigate during an investigation. All firms and all people, I believe, working in the regulated industry will be very cognizant of their obligation to be open and transparent with the central bank, to make prompt notifications. And certainly in, I'd say, our collective experience, the central bank requires, and firms generally live up to the expectation to make notifications quickly. But sometimes you need to investigate matters, and sometimes you need a little bit of advice. So it's really important to bear in mind that ongoing regulatory relationship. And I think the point that's been made also is you're in a scenario at this stage when something's broken, whether it's a system control failure or whether it's a relationship mm-hmm. with the central bank failure, something's broken, and it's incumbent on the advisors in any of these scenarios to work towards repairing that relationship, because ultimately at the end of the day, the firm or the individual is looking at continued existence under regulatory supervision, and that's really where you need to get. You need to get back to a place where that relationship can continue and can be put back on a stronger foothold.
Karen, you mentioned there are a couple of black letter law issues, I suppose, that you might call them, like privilege, the right not to self-incriminate, how that affects companies, how that affects individuals. Would you expand a bit more on that, and particularly from your own perspective, you know, where you see the real issues that sure. require legal advice?
Privilege is a really interesting one in the context of the regulatory relationship, and it's not just in an investigation scenario, it's in the supervisory scenario, and questions that we often get from clients are the regulator wants to see the legal advice, so they're looking for, you know, the privileged material. And obviously every case is different and every question needs to be answered in the context of the facts in which it arises. But often the regulator's perspective is, I'm your regulator, you have to be open and transparent. We expect that you want to be open and transparent. So why are you hiding from us? Why would you hide your legal advice from us? And that's really, you know, a central bank, Irish regulator, Irish regulated firms piece. It can be very different across different jurisdictions. And if you're dealing with a firm who is part of a global organisation, has its headquarters in the US, and you're trying to explain to the US GC, the US, you know, executive, why you are potentially going to give privileged information to the central bank, you have a bit of explaining to do to get that context across. So I think the privilege piece is really interesting. And what I think is interesting as well is the new legislation, so the Individual Accountability Framework Bill, proposes the codification of a practice that has really grown up over recent years, I think particularly in the investigation side, where limited waivers of privileged information can be utilised to give legal advice or whatever to the central bank. In the context of the investigation framework, the central bank has created a particular type of schedule that can be used for that. There was no sort of statutory provisions to provide for that. There are now statutory provisions in the new legislation. And I think that's a theme of the new legislation, is that a lot of what we have been seeing as practitioners in the context of investigations over recent years is now finding its way into a statutory foothold. Confidentiality, I think, is another piece that's finding its way into the bill in the legislation. And I think this is a really tricky and sort of potentially fraught with controversy piece. Investigations take place under confidentiality. That's not really set out in legislation, but it's understood and firms will keep it confidential. There's always a question mark of where does that line, you know, begin and end? What's, you know, something that's happened within the firm and what's something that's happened within the investigation, and where do the two collide? Interviews that are conducted, do the individuals who are being called to interview as witnesses, do they have an obligation to keep confidential from their firm, from their employer, the detail that is discussed at those interviews? The central bank requires that they do. But there can be lots of scenarios that might unfold where could something arise at an interview which is potentially an issue of jeopardy for the firm that should be brought to the attention of senior management, etc. Creates quite difficult questions for the individuals concerned and for their legal representatives mm-hmm. who attend those interviews, who may well not be the legal representatives who are advising the firm. And again, that brings into the fore issues around conflict, which I think many in this room as well will be used to dealing with.
Yeah, John, I mean, have you had similar reactions or similar experiences and have the same real crunch points?
Yeah, look, absolutely. Look, I'd mirror that what the guys have said, particularly Rob. It's not litigation. It's absolutely not litigation. No matter what you think it is, it's not litigation. When the letter hits, every case is different, clearly, and every scenario is different, but inevitably there's a conversation pretty quickly, how much is this going to cost? what's the fine going to be, cost on legal fees, but also what's the fine going to be. And from my experience, that is in the first call, inevitably that's something that comes up. The thing I'd say with that is it's extremely difficult to, and I'm glad from our panel discussion before this panel, it's not just me who finds it difficult to get an estimated fee or an estimated fine. It's across the board. It's very, very difficult to kind of get some kind of a grasp on the likely fine. Every case is different. There are guidelines that are set down by the central bank that I'll talk about later on, but the bottom line is there's not that many cases, so there's not a lot to base it on when you're trying to work out the likely fine that could be imposed. I guess there's some pretty obvious practical considerations when the letter hits. And the first of those is the deadline. I mean, we've spoken about that already. The deadline is unreasonable is one word you could use. You could probably go stronger than that. But the deadline is very tight. And again, as the guys have said, more often than not, you will be aware, your client will be aware, this is coming down the line. But inevitably, there'll be stuff in the letter that you maybe didn't expect, or a focus that wasn't expected in the letter. So some practical stuff is gathering information. I mean, that can take a long time in an ordinary set of litigation, but in this instance, we've got a very tight timeline. Gathering information across jurisdictions can be a big issue. Gathering documentation, clearly another massive issue, particularly in larger organizations. Like, again, if you've been preparing for this, you will have collated some of that documentation, but undoubtedly the letter will focus on some areas that you haven't thought about. The next issue, of course, is the letter will set out generally a number of what are called prescribed contraventions. So you've got to consider those on an item-by-item basis, and are you going to admit them or are you not going to admit them? And obviously you've got to consider that within the context of the timeline that's available to you. An obvious point is getting instructions. Again, you will more often than not have a point of contact with the organization, but you're going to need very timely instructions. There's no point in having someone who's going to be traveling or in meetings or whatnot. You need someone you can get hold of pretty quickly. And you know, you're going to be onto that person pretty frequently over the initial period of time, at least when you're preparing a response. Another issue, I guess, is from Patrick's point of view, is what are your client's priorities? It's obvious to say, what's the fine going to be and what it's going to cost me? And clearly that is a clear priority for clients. But I'm sure we've all had cases, I've one case in particular, where the level of the fine wasn't that much of an issue for the client. It was more about the publicity. As I'm sure everyone's aware, a publicity statement is issued at the end of the process. And that really was the focus for the client, was what's going to be said, who's going to hear about it, where is it going to be published, is it going to be picked up by the paper. So that was, for that particular case, that was the main focus. Karen has already touched on the importance of the ongoing relationship with the regulator. If you're Irish-based and plan on staying in Ireland, you're going to be meeting the regulator for years to come. So, you know, do you want to fight this case? Is it the case that's worth fighting? I mean, I had one case where the client was leaving Ireland, and that clearly coloured the way in which the correspondence was exchanged with the central bank, because it didn't have that ongoing concern to worry about and to consider. And then, what about fees? Again, pretty obvious, but it should be happening before you get the letter. But get onto your brokers, get onto your insurers, look at policies. Are fees covered and are fines covered? And then, just turning for a few minutes on to the individual. I mean, if fees are a big issue for a firm, and clearly for an individual, that's an even bigger issue and something that needs to be focused on. Karen has mentioned this already, the confidential obligation. There's issues acting for a firm, but there are a number of unique issues acting for an individual. The letter will say you have to keep this investigation or the correspondence that you received confidential. But what happens if the individual is no longer with the firm? What happens if they don't have access to their emails? What happens if their emails are archived? So can you go back to the firm and say, "Hi, remember me, can I get my emails back?" It's going to raise a few questions, undoubtedly, but I mean, they have to be able to defend themselves. So that's something they have to do. How do you go about requesting that? I mean, do you just ring up your former employer and say, "Please give me all my emails?" I mean, you can't necessarily do that. From a fees perspective, can they contact the firm's insurer? Again, from my experience, no, that has to go through the firm. I don't know if the guys agree with that, but that generally goes through the firm. So again, you're contacting your current or former employer saying, look, can you contact your insurer? So again, that raises issues. So managing the confidentiality obligations vis-a-vis the central bank is a difficult thing. The next thing then is the conflict issue. So you've got a potential scenario where you've got an employee or a former employee who is asking their former employer to give them access to emails, who is asking their former employer or their insurers to cover the costs that they're going to incur, while at the same time then maybe pointing the finger at their former employer or employees of the former employer. So, you know, they have to be allowed to do that. So, I mean, can a firm ask for an update as to how an investigation is progressing? Clearly not. But it is a strange position. And managing that conflict, it's not straightforward. It's clearly not straightforward. And it has to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. I mean, maybe just to finish off, I mean, from my personally, how I deal with it, if I have a concern, what you don't want to do is incur the wrath of the central bank. So if I have any concern, I will try to engage with them and say, look, in order to do X, we need to do Y, and try to get sign-off from them before any steps are taken. Now, depends on who you're dealing with, as to the level of engagement you'll get, but I guess the worst-case scenario is you do something where you contact the organisation, and it gets back to the central bank, and then your client's in trouble. So, look, there's multiple issues. There's just touching on a few there.
There's one, actually, just to pick up on that. I think it's a really interesting point, particularly when you're asking for an individual, is if the investigation letter lands in its current format, and there's I think many current formats because there's no prescribed format in terms of what the investigation letter needs to cover precisely, whereas under the new legislation, assuming it goes through in its current state, the investigation letter is going to be backed up by material now. So, you know, it's going to be up to the enforcement team who drafts the letter to decide what the appropriate material is, but it does look like at the very least, the subject of the investigation will get not just the prescribed contraventions and probably some particulars around that, but probably a copy of some relevant material, which I think will be a useful starting block as well, because one of the problems that particularly individuals, but firms also have, is that you're presented with a letter, which is the central bank's suspicion of the prescribed contravention, but it doesn't necessarily have the evidence. So it's not litigation. You know, you might have a discovery process in an investigation, but you're the one making discovery. You don't get anything from the central bank in terms of their rationale, their reasons, etc. And the proposed changes to the enforcement regime do look like they're going to give a bit more clarity or a bit more certainty in terms of the case that an individual is answering. So the investigation report goes to the subject, they get a chance to comment, and then it'll go back to a different team in the central bank to make a decision. So I think they're all good things in terms of proposed changes coming down the tracks.
Thanks, Karen. I do want to come back at the end when we're just summing up to see, do a straw poll and see whether people think there will be a culture change. I'm looking to see what the new provisions are. But just back to the balance and the tightrope. And John, I think you're going to reveal for people why this session is called Walking the Tightrope as a comparative law anorak, and tell us a bit about the US case that deals with this. I think is a balance, obviously, individuals and company, and also balance negotiating your way out of something which potentially could be very, very serious, if at all possible, or at least reducing the scope of what the investigation is about.
This is it. I think, Margaret, you were saying that, or it was either yourself or the Stone Roses that said, when you're on the tightrope, it's a long way down, and there's this massive peril that the respondent is facing, and then you have the dynamic that Karen has mentioned, where you're being invited by your adverse party. Look, we'd really like if you would waive legal professional privilege, and that'll go a long way to showing that you're being cooperative. That's generally adverse to your interests. If you're facing a 1 million euro liability or a career ending disqualification or prohibition, your preference will be not to give too much material to your opponent to help them bring home their case. But where the tension arises is if there's two ways in the bill, actually. One is that there's an individual conduct standard which says that you have to be open and cooperative, for which in theory you could be sanctioned. And the other one is that the sanction factors, the statutory sanctioning factors, mention this open and cooperative standards. That's something you're going to be measured against. You could get a higher fine if you're not, and a lower fine if you are. And while I am a comparative law anorak, I was also watching Billions, and there's a dastardly DA was pursuing a hedge fund billionaire, and it showed up all sorts of coercive practices in the Southern District of New York. And that's what the case of United States and Stein was about. And the particular sort of coercive power there was, and coming back to Karen's point about payment of legal fees, so there was a Department of Justice memorandum about indictment criteria and what federal prosecutors had to consider when they're considering whether to indict or not. And one of them was under the heading of cooperation and employee legal costs. So is the firm paying legal costs for individuals who are not cooperating with the government? And if the answer to that is yes, then that's a massive black mark against you and you're going to face indictment. And at the time, this was just after the Arthur Andersen conviction, that was viewed as a corporate death note or death sentence. Jeffrey Stein was one of the individuals. He's chairman of this accountancy firm in New York. He was indicted together with, I think, 19 others, 13 of them from KPMG, for setting up or being involved in tax shelters, which the government said involved tax fraud. And Mr. Stein had legal representation, which was paid for by his firm. And then after a series of sort of vigorous meetings with the prosecutors, that dried up and he was cut off. Initially, he retired and he was getting consultancy payments on his legal costs. Then that all ended. And it was made really clear to the firm that this was what cooperation looked like. So they, 13 of them, challenged their indictments. And they said, look, the government, it may have done this through the instrumentality of the firm, but nonetheless, it has interfered with our rights to legal representation and our Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. And you can see how that argument was made. And Judge Kaplan in the Southern District of New York agreed. And he said... He said that the firm refused to pay legal costs because the government held the proverbial gun to its head. So he didn't hold back in his views on this. He said the government has let its zeal get in the way of its judgment, and it's violated the constitution that it's sworn to defend. Okay, so strong words from Judge Kaplan, and maybe a bit of an unusual fact pattern. But the legal context is familiar to us. So we've constitutional protection for legal representation, for legal professional privilege. That's a core value in terms of your convention rights. You've ECHR convention protection in terms of self-incrimination, not just in criminal cases, in domestic law. And this is maybe an important point. When we look at the Engels criteria for convention law cases, whether it's criminal or not in domestic law is only a starting point, and it's kind of the least important of three factors. And the most important on the case law is, what's the nature of the penalty? What's the potential penalty that you're exposed to? And in every one of these cases, it's €1 million and disqualification for life. So it's the potential penalty is high. DB and Consob, Margaret, which you mentioned, is a good example. So there was an Italian broker. He was fined €200,000, €100,000, and €50,000. And the €50,000 was for not answering questions in interviews and interviews, I should say, by his by the Italian regulator. And the Court of Justice recognised, yeah, well, a natural person in that circumstance does enjoy a privilege against self-incrimination, and that privilege is engaged in this case. So just how soft are soft powers? Like, it was a soft power in United States and Stein. It was, the government didn't exercise a statutory power to make the firm drop its representation. It just pointed to the alternatives and exercised a kind of coercive convincing. I think the analysis really, it can't be on the label or on the form of the power, whether it's a power that you can find in the act or not. It has to be, well, look, you know, what's the actual effect on someone? Was the subject's will overborne? Was the cooperation or whatever it is, or the waiver of privilege, was it actually voluntary? And I suppose just I'll finish by saying I don't think there's any magic necessarily in relying on a soft power if the effect of that is corrosive on rights in the way it was in the United States and Stein, or even in something similar.
Well, soft powers, but very hard consequences, very serious penalties, and ones that are very deserving of the sorts of protections that you'd mentioned. I think it'll be interesting to see further development of the law in that regard, in this sphere, particularly with reference to the convention cases, to the European Charter case law, which brings in the convention cases, but also is developing off, perhaps spinning off in a direction that's perhaps even higher standards of protection that we see in relation to fundamental rights. And obviously this requires a bedrock of evidence, Rob, doesn't it? I mean, you need compelling evidence to be able to make your case. So, I mean, how does that come about? How does the book of evidence get prepared whenever you're investigating?
Yeah, I mean, Karen's made this point already, which is that the central bank sort of makes its allegations, it alleges the suspected prescribed contraventions before it's really begun the investigation phase, or the evidence gathering phase, I should say. So they tend to gather evidence in two ways, through documents and then through interviews with individuals, interrogations, as John describes them. So I think if you go down the document side first, I think this is a way in which central bank's investigation style has really evolved over the last 5 or 10 years. They now, as a matter of course, in all investigations, compel information to be provided to them under Section 27 of the 2013 Act, the Central Bank Supervision and Enforcement Act. And as time has gone on, the level of information that is required to be provided has significantly changed. So if you go back maybe 10 years, it was, you know, a handful of documents, if maybe a little bit more than that. But now, on very significant investigations, you can have multiple information requests. Think on a recent case whenever a long period of time we had something like 20-odd individual Section 27 requests. We had Section 27 requests on Section 27 requests. And the documentation in terms of volume that was requested ended up being in the hundreds of thousands, if not low millions, in terms of documents that had to be submitted. So these are really, really significant litigation style. I know we've said it's not a litigation, but litigation style, big, complex commercial litigation style, discovery style processes which require sophisticated IT, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes back to a point that John is making. One of the things we do tell clients now is that, in terms of setting the scene, that this is likely, that you could be spending a lot of money just on collecting and then submitting documentation. So that's a significant change over the last few years. I think now, again, sort of as a matter of course, we see that individuals are interviewed by the central bank. The central bank calls these individuals sort of witnesses of fact. And I know we were kind of chuckling at John calling them interrogations. I actually don't think that is too far from what they're like. They are very unlike a standard information gathering exercise. They're much more like a US style deposition. If you're an individual, including an individual who's in a relatively lowly position within an organization, you can still expect to have an interview panel of maybe 3 or 4 people, a stenographer, for it to be tape recorded, for the interview session to last, in some cases, several hours, with the occasional break for refreshments in the bathroom. So they're really, really demanding, challenging processes. Again, if you go back a few years, firms are a little bit more relaxed about them, and individuals might go sort of pop along themselves thinking it was an afternoon of conversation with the central bank to set the facts straight. It's kind of far from that now, and I think most individuals who go to these interviews would have legal representation, which leads us on to another challenge that we find from time to time, where the central bank, some teams in the central bank don't mind the law firm who's representing the firm to attend interviews with the individuals, putting aside the kind of the confidentiality issues that we've talked about. They don't have an issue with that. Sometimes though, in investigations, there is a significant amount of unhappiness about lawyers so representing both individuals or attending interviews and representing the firm. That's notwithstanding the fact that under the Constitution, you've got a statutory constitutional right to choose your representation, and it's for the law firms, the lawyers in question, to judge their, through their own professional standards whether they have a conflict or not. But the central bank argues that sometimes there are confidentiality issues. But these interview processes are really challenging and are now very, very common within the process. And you end up, I think, at the end of it with the firm having a good sense of the information that it has provided by way of evidence, having no sense at all generally about what has been given by way of oral evidence through witnesses, and having no sense of what the central bank supervision team may have sort of given and by way of sort of evidence in a case. And so you end up with a sort of mismatch, I think, of information. So you're trying to argue around sort of how is the information gathered. That's how you do it. It's never presented in a book of evidence. Sometimes you might get in investigation letters a bit more detail as to how the case has been constructed. But I think one of the constant sources of frustration for clients is that when the investigation information gathering phase has ended, there isn't an opportunity to sit down and discuss and debate with the central bank where the evidence has led to, and for you to reach a sort of a consensus on what the evidence says. So you can sometimes end up with a situation where you can have your own different interpretation or your own views of the facts. I mean, the facts should always be the facts, but you can end up, I think, sometimes having your own facts, which is not great, given the consequences for individuals and for firms at the end of the day. And that information gathering process, as well, I should say, takes ages. I mean, we've had cases that have gone on for 3 or 4 years. With large gaps in between the information being shared and then the central bank responding with an updated investigation letter. So they're long, long, drawn-out, expensive processes.
I mean, sitting in a room of lawyers, obviously we're all going to say that it seems a bit of a no-brainer that something as complex and perhaps lengthy and technical really should require lawyers to be involved. But it does seem extraordinary that there might even be a consideration that it's not necessary or perhaps not advisable. And particularly, I mean, I think when we were discussing earlier, we were talking about the competition authority judgment.
Yeah, and Margaret, yeah. And there's an interesting thing. So the sort of a feature of the enforcement setup is that information that the central bank has from any of its functions can flow into any other function. So this kind of cross-pollinization. So if something comes up in a pre-approval controlled function application, that can then crop up in an enforcement case. And kind of interestingly, you could be called for interview, or an applicant for a PCF could be called for interview and told you can bring a lawyer for the second one, but you can't for the first one. So you may have a difficult, protracted, recorded and transcribed interview that throws up issues that may surface for you down the road, and you haven't been able to bring a lawyer there. So it's concerning for lawyers, and it's an interesting factor, yeah.
I think it goes back to the point we discussed at the start, we've all mentioned this, which is that the regulator views it as a regulatory process, not a litigation process. And I've been accused, and maybe the guys have not been accused, but I've certainly been accused by the central bank of taking an overly legalistic approach to issues, which is quite hard not to do if you're a lawyer. So you're in the situation where you're in a process which is prescribed by regulation and will be increasingly prescribed by regulation under the new Act. Where the sort of the implicit expectation of the person applying the regulation, applying the legislation, is that you take an approach which is appropriate and not overly legalistic, and reflects the fact that it is a supervisory regulatory process and engagement that you're involved in. So to steal the analogy of the session, it really is a very difficult tightrope to walk sometimes, particularly to pick up on one of John's points, where you're dealing with a client who is remaining in the jurisdiction and has to have a day-to-day relationship with the regulator, which you don't want to break or burn or damage or destroy in any way. So it's an extraordinarily difficult tightrope to walk.
Two points that Rob mentioned. One is about, we talk about the interview, and it is a formal process, undoubtedly. The same applies for a settlement meeting. It's a very formal process. And you know, I have clients where, but why, how long is this going to take? both are going to take all day. I mean, even if you think you've very little to add, the interview will take all day, and settlement meeting, you won't get out of there early. I mean, even though you might have admitted the contraventions, it will take you all day. And then just one other point to pick up on is on the deadlines that I already mentioned, and Rob's mentioned again, that deadline repeats itself. So you could respond to the central bank, hear nothing for a considered period of time, and then you get a letter with another very tight timeline. So it's not just at the start of a process, it's throughout the process. And you know, again, perhaps it's a bit unreasonable that they've had a considerable period of time to consider your correspondence and you're given a short timeline. Now, I have to say, depending on who you're dealing with, you can get that extended out. But again, the initial response, the client gets a letter, respond by whatever, close business on Friday. Clearly, they're concerned, and you've got to then talk them down off the ledge and explain that's not, you know, we can't extend it out. But it is an ongoing theme throughout. It's the deadlines are very tight.
Yeah. Mm.
I think when you kind of stand back and you take on board all of this, the piece about it is that generally it's the firm that's under investigation, but the firm can't do anything without individuals. And the individuals depend on the central bank for their livelihoods, for their reputation, for, you know, their futures. So it is really, really personal when you're in the middle of it. And we talked about sort of conflicts from sort of the lawyer's perspective, but if you're a CEO or a director or a PCF, you're really concerned about your own position, and you're obviously concerned that you did your job correctly. So you can't really underestimate the pressure and the intense pressure that the people in the process are under. And so you layer over that the really short deadlines. And like in my experience, I think all of our experience, you know, that engagement with the central bank and the enforcement team is key. And, you know, the people in the enforcement team are lawyers generally. They're, you know, some of them are investigators. They come from different walks of life and are generally reasonable people who will engage with you and give you the extensions to the extent that you need them. They obviously have a mandate and a job to do as well. But I think because of that particular challenge for individuals, it's a very, very pressurised process. And it's not like litigation, because in litigation, you can take a legalistic approach, you can put up a defence, you know, you can sort of hide behind your lawyers. You can't do that in a central bank investigation. And generally speaking, the people within the firm don't want to do that. They want to be open and transparent. Like, people get up in the morning and they go to their jobs and they try to do a good job. And so you're trying to get that across in the context of the investigation. And generally speaking, you know, the central bank will understand that it's very pressurised for individuals. But it's really until you're in it with the individuals, until you're dealing with an Irish board, with INEDs, with PCFs, with US shareholders, or, you know, people in Luxembourg, you can't really appreciate the tensions and the intensity of that process. And it is oftentimes, it's done on the basis of guidelines, on practices that have grown up over a number of years and that aren't written down anywhere. And so it is difficult to navigate that tightrope. And certainly you don't want to be wearing very high heels to do it.
certainly not.
One last point. Inevitably, you're talking about things that have happened a long time ago. So you're trying to recall, you know, did that meeting happen? Did it not happen? Did we have a discussion about X or Y? I mean, it's the nature of litigation as well, I guess, but it's not something that happened recently. So there's a lot of trying to piece together what happened. And back to Karen's point, people are trying to do the best job they can. No one goes out to try and have the central bank writing letters about them or investigating them. And there is a lot of people trying to look back and go, kind of second guess themselves, I find. A lot happens, and it's a tough process for people to go through, undoubtedly.
Time has flown. It's been lovely talking to you, as I hope it's been lovely for the audience to hear what you have to say. I'd like to have the opportunity to invite a couple of questions. Before we do, we'd also like to get to the end of our tightrope, hopefully, or at least the timeline of our investigation life cycle. So fines was something you mentioned, John. If you could talk a bit about that. And Karen, I know we said it's settlement, but not as we know it. But it would be good to be able to wrap up on that too. So if we can take that time, and I'll just look to John Breslin for a steer. If he thinks we're going on for too long and I can hear the coffee cups rattling, then we can take as many questions as we can.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, maybe I'll start with the settlement. And as Rob had said, it's settlement, but not as you know it. So it takes place on a particular day. You're given the terms before you turn up. Often admissions will have been made before you turn up as well. There's obviously going to be points that are there for discussion. Most of the day is spent focused on the publicity notice, the enforcement notice, and there's an opportunity to get into the nitty-gritty about the level of the fine and various facts, I suppose, that are in contention are at issue, but it's all suppressed into one day, and if an investigation has gone on for 4 or 5 years, one day to do all of that and negotiate may be the wrong word there, the enforcement notice, it's not a whole lot of time to bring to an end a very intense process. And it is interesting, I think, as well, that the guidelines that the central bank has at present require admissions to be made. You can't reach a settlement unless you admit the contraventions. That's going to change under the proposed new legislation. It's interesting that the section that's being clarified, when you read it in its current legislation, would seem to suggest that you don't have to make admissions to reach a settlement now, but as I said, it's the guidelines that require you to do so. So I think that'll be interesting. The court approval piece, how's that going to work? You know, it's sort of when admissions are made and it has to go to court for the approval of the sanction or the confirmation of the sanction, and is it manifestly disproportionate, and what's the court going to be asked to look at, and do they get the investigation report? Yes, probably, but what else do they get? And all of that, I think, remains to be seen. But in terms of negotiation of the fine, and it'll be interesting to hear what other people have to say about this as well, but I think we've touched on the point. Fine's not always the most important thing. Central Bank has certain requirements and objectives in setting the level of the fine. It has certain constraints in terms of how far it can go with that. But again, you're into the very last day of a very long period to focus on that. And it sometimes isn't the most important thing.
Yeah, look, I'll keep this short and sweet. I mean, yeah, the fine, as I've mentioned, is hard to accurately predict what's going to be. We've spoken, if you take it through the process, the first step is a prescribed contravention has to be found. And we've referenced this throughout. What is a prescribed contravention? It's not a neat definition, unfortunately. It is a breach of an act or certain relevant acts or SIs, breach of a code, like the Consumer Protection Code. So that's the starting point, has a prescribed contravention or contraventions being admitted or being found. Next thing is, then, we've spoken about fines. So what are the level of fines that can be introduced or can be levied? About 10 years ago, there was a change to the law. So fines of up to 10 million euro for an organization or 10% of turnover, whichever is the greater. So it's not capped at 10 million. And I think from some of the fines this year, it's absolutely clear it's not capped at 10 million. So obviously, when you're advising your client, you need to know the turnover so you can advise on the likely level of a fine or the possible level of a fine. For an individual, then, it's a million euro is what the fine is the max fine that's payable. We've spoken a little bit about the criteria that are set down. So there are criteria that have been produced in guidelines by the central bank as to what they will take into account. There's four broad headings, and they all have subcategories. I'm not going to go into them now, given we're out of time. But the nature and seriousness of the contravention is one. Previous conduct of the entity, has it been fined previously, is another. Things like creating a deterrent effect. I mean, it's one of the stated aims of the central bank is creating a deterrent effect to the industry, and how fines have been levied in similar cases. Just to turn very briefly in the minute or two we've left, to the level of fines. Last year, 2021, highest ever level of fines, nearly 70 million. It's been dwarfed this year, nearly over 200 million, I think, in fines this year. And look, I think it's inevitable that we can see that trend continuing. I think we can all speak of colleagues who have joined the Central Bank Enforcement Division over the last number of years. They've lawyered up. They're continuing to lawyer up. It's only going one way as far as I can see. And look, in light of what we're talking about here, individuals are going to be more and more in the spotlight. I mean, to date, most of the settlements are with organisations, but it's inevitable that's going to change. Just there's no way to get around that.
Before we go to questions, and I see there is a roving microphone, so perhaps if anybody would like to ask a question, if you might just put up your hand and then we can get the microphone to you. But before we do, very quick spot pop quiz. The new bill, is it, and individual accountability, is it going to make a cultural difference, do we think? You can say yes or no if that's what you want.
I'd say, well,
I think it depends what you mean by cultural difference. I think if you take the IAF is effectively a copy out by and large of the UK regime, and if you speak to lawyers in the UK and firms in the UK, they would say that SMCR, which is the UK equivalent, has led to improvements in decision making, and there's better rigor around how things are done within firms and how responsibility is allocated, etc., etc. There may be some cultural differences, but I'd echo the points that John and Karen made. Ultimately, people within the firms that we work for, clients of ours, are trying to do the right thing. People genuinely do try and do the right thing. So there may be cultural changes in terms of how things work internally, but I don't think we have an industry where there are tons of bad actors who will all of a sudden become good actors just because there's individual accountability going forward. I don't think you're going to see that sort of shift.
Can I sidestep that and comment instead, not on the culture in industry, but on the procedural culture? And I think that the signs are the bill, despite some reservations, it's a little bit more structured and a little bit more transparent. So I see a change of some sort there, which is welcome.
I'm going to disagree. I think the devil is in the detail. There's a lot more to come from the central bank in terms of how it's all going to work, what reasonable steps are, how all that's going to look. Do I think it's going to make a change for the better? Look, when people have to think about what they do and they have to think about how they record it, that's generally speaking a good thing. And we talked about the investigation evidence and the report and everything. So, if there's more kind of intentionalism around record keeping and governance, that must be a good thing.
Yeah.
Potential concern, inertia. I've to write down everything I'm doing before I do it or when I'm doing it. So, some of the feedback from industry that we have is I'm going to need two people to do my job. One to kind of follow me around and note everything that I do, and the other one to actually do the stuff I'm supposed to do. So there has to be, a balance. And I think, the central bank's had its first ever financial services conference over today and yesterday, and it's, committed to engaging more with industry. And we as practitioners and the people within the central bank have an obligation, I think, to the financial services industry in Ireland.
Absolutely.
To make that work. So I think, engagements like this, discussions like this have to be a good thing. Culture, improving culture, that has to be a good thing.
Yeah, look, I'll keep it very brief. I think hopefully it'll improve the system that's in place. But just one just practical thing a client said to me recently, that they're going to now have minutes of a meeting and their own minutes. And that's the only way they can protect themselves. So it's a risk-reward thing for people in those roles. I mean, the level of risk now is very significant. And are people going to want to do it?
I'd have to advise that client not to.
Well, they're so scared now of what could happen.
Yeah.
So is it worth it? Look, it's...
You can do a one-year on next year to see if the bill has been enacted and what might have changed. I believe we have a question. Perhaps if you might like to just identify yourself and the panel member that you'd like to direct your question to, please. Thanks very much.
Anyone who wants to take the question. My name's Peter Oakes. I'm a solicitor. I'm an INED on regulated firms, which are impacted by this regulation and this law. And many years ago, I was involved in writing the original law as a director of enforcement. I think for regulated firms, the first things we're going to do is actually go through the compliance issues of mapping out responsibilities. We're probably not going to think too much around the point of enforcement and all the rest, but we will have to get there. You're absolutely right. I'd love to ask you about the High Court confirmation process, but maybe that's a bit too much. But the real question is the divergence of interests. So you have a company that's facing the prescribed contravention route, and you have an individual. And the individual, at the moment, it can't be proceeded against unless that participation link is there. So individuals will complain that, well, my company rolled over, and they agreed to settle with the central bank, and suddenly that's being used as a cause of action against me. So I'm just sort of generally interested about the divergence of interest between the senior executives on the one hand as individuals and the company on the other side, which is the regulated institution. Do you see those interests being aligned, diverging? And in which case, are we looking at the American model where the senior executive gets their lawyer dealing with the central banks whilst the business is getting its law firm dealing with the regulator?
To say something. Yeah.
I think that's likely to be the case going forward, or possibly the case going forward, given that central bank will be able to have investigations simultaneously against individuals and firms. I think today, Peter, that hasn't been the case, and you know, you've had to prove a case against the firm first, then individuals subsequently. We've seen cases where individuals have been intimately involved in the firm's response to an investigation, then become the subject of an individual investigation. And they've probably known that all the way through the investigation against the firm, that that was a likelihood or a possibility. And you just have to rely on them being professional. I mean, they're in an impossible position in those circumstances because they have to do their job, acting in the best interests of their employer, the firm, for a period of time, knowing at the back of their minds that this admissions that are made, the evidence that's provided, could be used against them subsequently. So that has been an issue today, but one that I think has just been impossible to manage for individuals. I think going forward, if there is a benefit to the participation link being broken, it's that if you're an individual, you will be able to argue that I have separate rights here, I have a separate interest that needs to be protected. But then we're going to end up in having investigations that are much more complex, lengthy, expensive, because to the point you make about the US process, it's going to become a lawyer's feeding frenzy around some of these bigger cases. So
surely not.
It's awful, isn't it? So we'll see what happens.
John?
Sorry, I lost my thought there. If you wouldn't say anything.
Thinking of the piranhas or the goldfish.
Like, I don't think
I echo what Rob said, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we're seeing it already, you know, over recent years, that kind of focus on individuals has been to the fore in any event. So, look, it's certainly, it's challenging, it's going to be tricky, but I think Rob's point, you have to rely on the individuals being professional. I think in our experience, that is the case and will continue to be the case. There will be additional challenges, I think, as this new legislation comes through. One point, actually, though, is like firms obviously will have an obligation to train individuals and to put in place supports and controls. So, you know, there's a potential for divergence, but there's actually a mutual interest in making sure that it's done properly from the outset. So again, if we're trying to focus on the positives of all of this, and you know, the experience in the UK has worked out to be a positive thing, I think a lot of it is going to come from the central bank and the central bank's attitude towards it, and the tone that's coming from the central bank in terms of how individuals feel it will be rolled out, implemented and supervised, and ultimately, is it going to be, you know, off to the gallows, or this is a good culture and we're you know, proud to support it and stand over it.
Yeah, it's really an element to watch this space. I mean, no one knows exactly how it's going to pan out, but I read an article about how this scheme's introduced in Australia, and it said that precisely zero banking executives had been individually investigated as a result of the scheme in Australia. So who knows?
But it's kind of the same in the UK. So to date, I think there have been very, very few cases against individuals, yeah, under the SMCR regime. But the UK historically has taken, the FCA, PRA, have taken a lot more cases against individuals. So they have, it's not quite 50-50, but they have a significant percentage of their cases are against individuals as opposed to just against firms. We have, I mean, a handful of cases against individuals that are all against firms. I think it's going to be a shift going forward. It is likely to be a shift towards more individual, so cases against individuals. They may or may not be taken as a result of breaches of the individual accountability framework and SIA, but I think just the direction of travel, from the regulators have been talking about it for years now, is going to be more cases against individuals.
Yeah, and just the last thing I wanted to mention was about this informality and expedition. So the inquiry is to be informality, but that's the inquiry stage, not the investigation stage. Now that may be a sort of a pernickety point, but the other thing is post-Zalewski, I mean, informality and expedition is all very well, but you still have to do law in the words of the Chief Justice. So I think that's an important factor, and we have a contribution to make there, and the FSBA does as well.
Yeah. I believe we have another question. Are we allowed, Chairman of the Association? Are we allowed one more question? We're allowed one more question. Thanks very much.
Hi. Well, actually, I think it was covered in the last few comments. I was going to ask about the fact that there hasn't been many sanctions under the senior managers regime in the UK, and how we think it might be different here. I'm Gerald Byrne from Philip Lee.
Well, we had an event a while ago now that the Minister for Finance spoke at, and he sort of expressed the view, the point was made to him, and his view was that the aim of the regime is not to see a wave of cases against individuals. That might come separately because a central bank changes its sort of policy position and its approach to cases against individuals. But the aim of the IAF and SIA is not to see cases against tons and tons of individuals and to see sort of heads in stocks. I think back to the point that Margaret made, the question she had, which is, well, there going to be cultural changes? I think the real aim of it is to change culture, whatever that means, to make sure that people behave in a way that's appropriate and are mindful of their legal and regulatory obligations and everything that they do. And if you think about it, if culture improves or behavior improves and continues to improve, by definition, there should be fewer cases rather than more. This is about sort of prevention in a way rather than sort of deterrence through tons of cases.
One of the points they make is that the FCA still can't link the wrongdoing to individuals under that regime. I'm not sure if that's going to be the case here as opposed to just a general improvement in behaviour.
In the sense it's really hard to prove cases against individuals, and that's one of the challenges I think the central bank will have. Again, if you look at lots of the UK cases, they tend to be examples of really egregious behaviour by individuals. And look, we can talk all day about the challenges of doing cases against individuals. It's difficult to prove a regulatory breach on Rob
Kane. And I think panel two is going to do that very expertly, and we're looking forward to that discussion as well.
Absolutely, and it's been a really very, very interesting discussion. I hope that the audience has enjoyed it as much as I have. I think we've got a very serious 1 hour of CPD under our belts. So all I would like to do now is say thank you very much to our four expert panelists, and thank you very much for being such a good audience, and we'll look forward to hearing what panel two has to tell us. Thank you.